This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street. Do you need a conference room for your next meeting? Learn more by visiting 100bogart.com. Hey, this is Hannah Forden. I'm the program manager here at Heritage Radio Network. This year, we're celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary, and I want to thank all of our listeners and members for being a part of an incredible year of food radio. We never would have made it this far without all of you. So HRN is now in its summer fun drive, and this is when we turn to you and ask that you make a donation to help ensure a bright future for food radio. Whether you listen to one show or 20, there's a reason why you keep tuning in week after week. All of our content is powered by a small nonprofit, and we rely on your generosity to keep going. Help us keep broadcasting the most thought-provoking, entertaining, and educational conversations happening in the world of food and beverage. So become a member today. To celebrate our 10th anniversary, we have some brand new member gifts available online, so I encourage you to snag your new favorite pizza-themed t-shirt or enamel pin today and show the world how much you love HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate so you can snag your 10th anniversary member swag. And thank you.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about innovators, entrepreneurs, and career changers who make up the food and beverage industry. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch, and I have some exciting news that may not be so surprising to regular listeners. We've been doing this in kind of a sneaky way, so you might have a suspicion that this was coming. Unfortunately, Jenny is moved on to new and exciting adventures on the West Coast, and so is not going to be co-hosting the show with me anymore, and I'm sad to see her go, but I'm really looking forward to following her adventures in California, which you can do as well, at Chef Jenny Dorsey on Instagram. But I have a new co-host. You may have heard her voice on recent episodes. She was the guest co-host on our episode last week, and we interviewed her about a month ago as a full episode. So Valerie Lomas is our new co-host. I don't know, Valerie. Thanks for jumping into this with me.
Yeah, Ethan. I'm excited to be a part of this podcast. I think we both obviously have a lot in common as career changers and as people who have peddled everything from ice cream to French macaroons. And I'm excited to be here with you each week and talking to other amazing, dedicated, passionate food people.
And speaking of dedicated and passionate food people, we have a doubleheader for you this week. Chani Laux and Kent Laux, who are the founders of Encore Cambodian Foods. Chani is the chef and founder, and Kent is the general manager, and you're also married, right?
That's right.
So that's always, it's always fun having co-founders and a couple. Because the conversation, there's just a lot of dynamics in that relationship, as I'm sure we'll get into. So tell us, just to kind of kick off the conversation, what is Encore Cambodian Foods and how did you wind up starting it?
Well, Encore Cambodian Food, we're making a lot of Cambodian cooking paste, condiments that are essential in Cambodian kitchen. And before I started this company, I was working as an engineer for 30 years in the Silicon Valley, and I work with the aerospace industry as well as biotech industry. And about 9 years ago, when my mom passed away, I have time that I reflect on what I'm doing and reflect on her life, how she had overcome challenges and creating her own triumph, her life, as when she grew up in Cambodia, she never had a single day at school. And then when she turned 14, both of her parents passed away. And being a young girl at that time in Cambodia, there's no social program to help her. So she spent all of her young adult life moving from home to home and help people keep the house and cooking for them. And, you know, ever since I grew up and learned about her story, I was always admire what she had done and how strong she had become. You know, she's the one that actually keep us all humane under the Khmer Rouge. You know, she's allowed us to, the way she treated us and fighting for us, allow us to have keep the dignity as a human being. And the fact that, you know, she lost a lot and then came here as a single mom, raising four children, and all of us become engineer and shop owner. All of those that she gone through, nobody know anything about her. So when she passed away, I felt like I want to do something in honor of her. So I, it didn't come naturally, actually. You know, it just happened that the same time our daughter was in starting college, and after like 3 months in the dorm, she called me up and she said, "Mom, can you make the hot sauce that Grandma used to make?" I'm like, oh, you know, and I almost cried that instant request that she had for me, and I said, it just kind of jumped on me that, you know, maybe that's it, because Mom never had any education, nothing that people was really impressed about, but she had this. Was amazing cook, and when she make hot sauce, she doesn't make like a few jars. She make big batch, and I was help her doing that all the time. And I remember used to complain, why you have to make so much, you know? But she make that big batch and she give it to friends and family. And anybody call up and say my hot sauce is out, and she's like make another big batch. So when she was with us, we never had to buy hot sauce. So when my daughter asked for it, I felt like that moment that that's what I want to do, carry on her legacy of sharing food.
Yeah, and I mean, you now own this line of condiments that's really successful, but you're also now an author, and you published a memoir, Short Hair Detention, in 2017. And yeah. I imagine you kind of got to share that legacy and tell a little bit more of your story and history in that memoir as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that memoir was something that I always wanted to get, you know, I always wanted to finish. And, you know, surviving the Khmer Rouge under 4 years, a lot of starvation and sickness and hard labor, separated from my family. I remember many times that when I go through any huge adversity, I told myself as a young girl that if I ever make it out alive, I want to make sure that my future children know what happened to us, what we've gone through. And then when I came here in 79 in Lincoln, Nebraska, I didn't know any English, so that hope was just kind of disappeared. And even my own language, Khmer, I was rusty because I spent 4 years without any school, just labor camp, day after day, and starving and sickness. So it was one of my bucket lists that I want to finish the book. And it just happened that 3 years ago, when I lost my job from the corporate world, instead of jump back and looking for the next job, I decided to work on my bucket list. And that was, you know, to complete the book before I go back to the corporate world. But one thing led to another. After I finished the book, I, busy with the food business that I started 9 years ago. So,
we obviously encourage all of our listeners to go out and buy the book and read the book. Would you share with us a little bit about your experience growing up under the Khmer Rouge and some of the topics that you cover in the book?
Yeah, I wrote the book from a perspective of a young girl, and not as I am right now, but as what she'd gone through during that time. And for example, just the name of the book should tell the audience a lot of what it's all about. And I decided to name it Short Hair Detention because I'm trying to communicate to a young adult growing up in this country to understand the meaning of freedom, especially to like teenager in grade school. You know, when that happened, I was 13 years old. that if you don't understand the meaning of freedom, just imagine that even the length of your hair being controlled by the government. And for me, when I was taken away from my parent, going into my first labor camp, they told me that all girls have to get your hair cut. And, you know, after going through the first season of starvation, when I talk about starvation, it's like, you know, people can have a pretty good idea what it feels like. Like, you're hungry all the time, and you're losing weight. You can't think of anything. You eat anything. But the fact that, you know, the intimate thing that you actually feel, you know, you feel like your stomach is ingested itself, and you wish that you die instead of suffering another day of not having anything to eat. But anyway, all of that, you know, when after gone through all of that, and when they told me that they're gonna cut my hair, I was thinking, it shouldn't matter, right? But it did. It hit me really hard, because before they tell me that, I still have hope that someday I'll get a chance to see my parent again. But when I heard that, all the hope that I had was just gone. It just felt like, what else are they going to do to me? I don't even have choice to control my body. So all that hope I had was just gone. And then I spent 4 years under the Khmer Rouge. So what happened is, when they lined up all my friends to get a haircut, they didn't cut my hair, because my hair was already short to begin with. In that instant, I felt like, you know, a little win, like a triumph, that even if they want to control me, the situation didn't allow them to control me. And right then, I felt like they cannot control me 100%. But on top of it, it's just all related to hair as a young girl, you know. I always want to keep long hair, but my mom said, you're not old enough to care for your hair, so she's always cut my hair. So all of this thing is related to being a young girl, want to keep long and beautiful hair. And I spent 4 years in communist Khmer Rouge, my hair never grew, not even an inch.
It stopped growing.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's really, I mean, your story is, it's really inspiring, to have survived that, and to have come to America as a refugee and end up in Lincoln, Nebraska, not knowing English. And, you know, I believe in the memoir, you kind of talk a little bit about how you end up, you know, sitting in this little library and learning the consonants and vowels,
yeah,
and putting the words together. And then you end up getting a master's of science in applied mathematics,
yeah,
and are working in the tech industry for, was it 30 years?
30 years.
Yeah.
In the aerospace and the biotech. You know, it's when we came here, many Cambodian refugees came here. We came here surviving the genocide. So we are completely lost everything and had nothing to bring here except, you know, a smile and bare hand. And it just, after you've gone through that, everything is heaven. You know, and when they told me that I have to go to school, I was like, okay, I understand. I have to learn English somehow. But then they told me that I have to go to school with the American kid. I was just like, become almost like nauseated. I was going to throw up. I said, did they know what we've been through for the last 4 years? Because I didn't, you know, not to mention English, but even my own language, I never really learned anything. I never write any words down. And now in this new country, new system, and we were told to go to high school. But I also, you know, they also told us that that's the law of the land. You have to go to high school. Otherwise, for your age, you're breaking the law. And having survived, you know, under the control of the Khmer Rouge, you never challenge authority. So to me, and then I realized that, you know, that's all I have to do, doing homework. And it's like just one thing after another. And, you know, a lot of my ESL teacher, English as a second language, they were, you know, very welcoming me here. And it was just a great opportunity, just one thing after another.
And Kent, how did you meet? Tell us a little bit about your background and how you and Chani met.
I grew up in Nebraska also, so I did what most young boys and girls do in Nebraska is go to University of Nebraska. So we had a couple of classes that we shared together, and so I think I annoyed her at first, and then we started to have a relationship after that. So, it was great.
And you also went on to have a career in tech and are also very involved in the food business. Was food important for you growing up, or is that something you've adopted as an adult?
Well, I had when I was very young, I people would say, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I want to be a chef," not really knowing much because maybe because I was working hard as a farm boy, you're always hungry, and mom's food's the best, and you want to, you know, do what mom does. That never really happened. I didn't turn into be a chef, but I really appreciate great food. With the tech industry, I was fortunate to travel the world and enjoy food, you know, at very nice restaurants all over the world. And I would come home and tell Chani from trips about all these dishes and things like that that me and my colleagues would experience. So we shared that a lot. We shared, you know, good food for our children. We take them out to nice restaurants and try to get, you know, ever since they were little, trying to get them to appreciate good food as well.
What did you grow up eating?
Pretty much meat and potatoes, you know, where that's the part of the country where...
And casserole.
Oh, yeah. A lot of frozen casseroles and lunch. There is no lunch. It's dinner and supper. And you learn to... Yeah, you just really don't get exposed to a lot of meat and potatoes. And
what's the difference between dinner and supper?
Oh,
for
yeah.
Those of us who might not be too sure.
Exactly. So, I think it's mostly a farming sort of a culture sort of thing where you work 12-hour days, you get up with the sunset and with shovel in your hand, and off you go, you know, to do whatever needs to be done. And by the time noon rolls around, you're just you need fuel. So dinner is a bigger meal, and it's always served at the middle of the day. And supper is usually lighter. I mean, supper is kind of a normal, you know, dinner that you would have in a metropolitan area. But yeah, the lunchtime was the big deal.
And you call it dinner.
Dinner, yeah. Every time I go home to visit there, I get kind of confused by it, too. I have to step back in time. And.
You know. So tell us about the process of starting the business. How did the two of you go from a career in tech to starting a Cambodian food company?
You know, I in my last 10 year working in a biotech, I actually involved in FDA process, right? Food and drug, and which is like not the food part, but the biotech drug part. And that also the fact that I learned from Ken's mom how to can food, and Cambodian doesn't can. We don't can food. We just go to the backyard and take it out and chop it. We don't even have a refrigerator. So the concept of canning was very foreign to us. That's probably why you don't see many Cambodian shelf, you know, shelf stable product. But because of my experience of working in the FDA environment and also learning to can food from my mother-in-law and cooking from my mother, I have this confidence that, you know, why aren't there Cambodian food out there? You know, that shelf stable. And we had Cambodian cuisine has a unique flavor that most people haven't even tried yet. So that gave me like the confidence of let's do something about it, right? And it helps me, I started off with the hot sauce. And then my next product was lemongrass. That was the one that received the award, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you actually brought a little jar of the lemongrass paste in, and I mean, the aroma of it, it's really incredible.
It's filling the whole studio. We opened it right before we started recording, before we turned on the mics, and I can still smell it 20 minutes later.
Yeah, and you know, I was reading that last month at the 65th IFMA Gala, you received the Food Service Innovation Award for this product, which is really incredible when you think about the other people who are in that room. It's huge brands like Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like, it's pretty amazing that you have achieved like that much in the food industry kind of that quickly.
Yeah. So I think we are very grateful for the opportunity to be in front, to receive that award amongst other food giant industry. And it's just a good opportunity to be out there in front of food service industry. I, unfortunately, was not able to participate in the award gala because I was already have prior commitment to help cooking food and fundraising for homeless in San Francisco, and I didn't want to let them down. So I sent him Ken to...
I got to go. I was the imposter, the Cambodian, food chef. But it was the people at IFMA were just so gracious, and, they really appreciate innovation, and it was kind of like supporting and excited to bring in some, new ideas and share with these food giants. And we're just really excited. I mean, not just with the retail size, but having food service customers and manufacturers that are interested in Cambodian food, right? Including Cambodian food. And they would share with us that their customers, their consumer, the people that they serve food to, they're more and more demanding, of course, right? And partly because of food programs like this where they learn more about dishes, they want to try, they want to experiment with different things. So Jenny's recipe and the lemongrass paste seem to fit the bill for them. So we're excited.
Well, to have gone, I mean, especially to have won this award without a full professional background in food. Can you tell us about that, the decision to change careers, to start this company? They're both looking at each other,
yeah,
waiting for the other one to...
Well, I think it, again, go back to the confidence or the feeling that why aren't Cambodian food out there? We have something to share, right? So, and also related to mom and carry on her legacy. And I remember it's not that easy. But it was good, right? Not that easy to continue doing it because when I told you about making the first batch of hot sauce, mm-hmm. I shared with my colleague, and my colleague want to buy, and I for Christmas gift, and I said no, next time I'll make another batch. I'll give you a lot because now I know you like it. And she said, no, this is for a gift, so I had to buy it from you. So it spawned one thing after another, and I start to make that hot sauce. And every weekend while I work as a senior staff system engineering in the biotech industry, I have engineering report to me to get my responsibility to lead the project, to develop new project for the company. On the weekend, I would get on the BART, go from San Jose to San Francisco, and stand in the ferry building and have people sample it and cross my finger that they would sample. And every time somebody bought a job, which is like a couple of dollars, I got so excited. And for many, many weekends, I would do that. And I would get on the BART, and every time I passed by Washington Hospital, where I would spend 6 weeks day in and day out, take care of my mom when she was on intensive care, I say my love to her. So it was just very personal. And I do this for 6 years before we quit our career job and taking the food job 100%. And the 100% part in food is that one of the things that I was confident about beside the passion of carrying on my mom's legacy was every time I do demo, I have this table in front of the shop, and the shop owner is very supportive. And I put the sign say Cambodian food. And sometimes in the ferry building, it's so packed. People are like in the hallway, just packed back and forth. And many times people would just zoom into my demo table, not for the smell of the food, what the food looks like, but for the mere fact that we say Cambodian food. Mm-hmm. So that to me is like, we might find something here that people are
hungry for.
It was motivational, right? You kind of put yourself out there and see what's going to happen. And many times they would ask Jenny, what else you got? What else can you do? And then We started trying different sauces and pastes and coming up with recipes and sharing things, and started to get some more traction, you know. And I think in the beginning we weren't really sure if people were into Cambodian food that much, because there really aren't that many restaurants. So
it's hard, you know. I spend a lot of my time, now that the product is done, I spend a lot of my time educating people what it's supposed to smell like, taste like, and how you prepare with this paste, because, you know, it's just because the product's ready doesn't mean people are ready to use it. Mm-hmm. So I do things that anytime I can get in front of people to cook for them. So we have like a private dinner, we have pop-up and
cooking classes,
and I even have opened my house for Airbnb experience. You know, and I show people how to cook it. At the end of the experience, they can taste the food and they can have a jar, go back home, cook it.
So you actually brought some stuff for us to taste. I don't know, maybe we'll taste it during the break and then we can like
report back. Things into the microphone.
Let's do that.
I don't know if people like hearing us eat things, but
I'm new to this, Ethan.
Actually, on that note, let's take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay tuned.
Okay, thank you.
This episode was brought to you by 100 Bogart, a new building in Bushwick, Brooklyn, with meeting and event spaces available for on-demand booking. Looking for the next perfect outdoor location for your next gathering? Host your next event at 100 Bogart's impressive rooftop, just steps away from the Morgan L Stop. It's one of the largest and tallest roof spaces in Bushwick, boasting 360-degree views of Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Queens. 100 Bogart's rooftop is available for your next networking event, fundraiser, special performance, or photo shoot. There's approximately 5,000 square feet, ample space for up to 100 guests. For more information on hosting an event at 100 Bogart's rooftop, email info@100bogart.com or call 718-362-3539.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Korsha Wilson, and I'm the host of A Hungry Society here on HRN. A Hungry Society focuses on highlighting dope people doing amazing work in food, and we talk about how we can make the culinary world a more diverse and inclusive space. You can join the conversation by checking out A Hungry Society wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back. I'm going to do the reintroduction because Valerie is eating amazing chicken that Chani and Kent brought for us.
It's so good.
It's so good.
I think I was just supposed to like try it, but I'm eating. Like, I will leave some for you, Ethan.
Thanks. Anyway, you're listening to Why Food. We're here with Chani and Kent Laux, who are the respectively chef and general manager of Angkor Cambodian Foods. We spent a lot of time in the first half of the interview talking about Cambodian food and the process of starting the company. Could you give us an overview of what is Cambodian food? What are some of the classic flavors, the classic dishes that you're now making at Angkor?
So, you know, if you ever go to like Cambodian's house and you smell this aroma, most likely it involves lemongrass paste. And we use lemongrass paste a lot in our cooking. We use it to marinate, to do stir fry, to steam fish with, to make soup. You know, a lot of time you see like picture on Facebook, like Cambodian food group, and for the most part, it will involve lemongrass paste. And the lemongrass itself take a lot of effort to prepare, and that was one of the reasons I decided to make lemongrass paste. It's like the essential ingredient to cook many Cambodian dishes. What you taste in a paste is, for the most part, people are probably familiar with the organic ingredient, you know, like lemongrass, galangal, turmeric, a few lime leaf. But what's unique to lemongrass compared to other like bordering country like Vietnamese and Thais and even Burmese food is the proportion that we put in and the process of how we, you know, prepare those dishes make each culture unique. And Cambodia definitely has some unique dishes that haven't been explored by many people. And we don't eat, our sauce, our food is not so much spicy and also less sweet than most other Southeast Asia food.
Yeah, I mean, I just need to echo that, like, this chicken marinated in this lemongrass paste was, like, so good. I mean, I love, like, Southeast Asian food, and uh-huh. I'm probably less familiar with Cambodian food, but now I'm going to be, like, looking for it. So thank you for sharing
yeah,
that.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I actually wanted to touch on something because, you know, I was just, like, reading online, and I saw that, you know, so your memoir, Short Hair Detention, won an award from the state of Nebraska. And, you know, you made this really great comment about how even though, you know, you lived in Nebraska, you went to high school there, you went to college there, you weren't quite sure, since you've now been living in San Francisco, like, what exactly qualifies a Nebraskan.
Yeah.
And how, you know, you are sure that you're a U.S. citizen because mm-hmm. you've gone through the process.
Right, right.
And I really loved that because it's kind of like, I don't know, I live in New York City. I've been here 9 years and I think I'm like, am I a New Yorker? I don't know.
Yeah,
and
right,
it's like,
right.
who?
Especially for people like us who was born in different part of the world. And to me, I remember when I submitted my book for Nebraska Book Award, I wasn't sure that they're going to I wasn't sure that I might qualify because I wasn't born in Nebraska. And when I was accepted my book to be reviewed, there was a level of confidence that they did count me, even though I wasn't born there. And then to receive the award, it was like, oh, so my experience outside of Nebraska and then spend 10 years in Nebraska was part of Nebraska heritage. You know, and they see it that way. The organization that gave us this award, they see it that way so much that they, when they took my book and to be in a special collection of Nebraska author, you know, they call it Heritage Room. It's like in a special room in the library that is locked up. I mean, locked up, but. Special, you don't go there unless you have the permission to go mm-hmm. and have reason to go research it. And my book now is in that room. And I remember when I hear that, it was touch me. It touched me like I am part of you. You had accepted me, even though I told myself that, you know, I'm from Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of time when people say, where are you from? You know, automatically I say I'm from Nebraska because I live in California. And then they look at me like, I said, okay, you want to know before then. Then it's like, I almost like give them a look like,
yeah.
Why does it matter?
Mm.
But I always count myself as Nebraska because that's how to me, when I first, my first 10 years was in Nebraska, you know, I learned to love football and all that. So it was like
I know another,
acceptance.
I know another reason why you're Nebraskan because... she would go, when we were dating, she would go to the farm, and even, you know, after dating and married, she'd go to the farm, and she would be the first one to jump in the truck with my dad and go do some errand somewhere.
I love, yeah, and you also, so. You also married a Nebraskan.
So. Yeah. How would your kids answer that question? Where are they from?
Oh, I think they think that they're from California. Yeah, but we took them to Nebraska every year, at least once a year. It's hard to see what they think, but they are very happy and proud just being part of diversity in California.
What do they think of your decision to leave a good career in tech and,
oh,
and start
I know,
a food business?
Right? They're like, Mom, are you sure? I think we're crazy.
They, you know what? I think they're proud too because when we go to shows like last year when we came to the Summer Fancy Food Show here in New York City, they both came along and helped us in the booth.
Uh huh. Yeah.
Right. And so it was like they saw that, yeah, they could see the interest in the crowd, and I said, maybe they're not crazy. You know, this is,
well, that take a cool while, but at the beginning, it's almost like, what are you doing? You know, and yet, you know, I'm so, yeah, I'm convinced that this is the right thing to do. At some point, I felt like I have to go back to work, but I'm not going back to the corporate world. I'm going to go work at Costco or Whole Foods so I can learn from the experience and help building this new, you know, entity that I'm trying to build for. But now I think Kent's right, you know. Our son is 25 years old, and he's an actuary working for Blue Shield. And our daughter is the older one. She's 27, and she's getting her PhD from USC. But they still, every summer, they come here to help us working the booth.
How do you think the experience for them of watching their parents go through this entrepreneurial process to start the company, how do you think that has shaped the way that they think about their careers?
And also their heritage, yeah, because I feel like, you know, like your identity as a Nebraskan, their identity as like Californians, but also like, you know, your daughter was like, I want grandma's hot sauce. Like, yeah, it's this beautiful like connection to their heritage also.
Yeah, exactly. I think that they, for example, simple thing, but still I'm very proud of what they become. Like when I walk, you know, to place with Richard, they're very generous and very supportive of people standing out there and trying to make a living. It doesn't matter what it is, you know, selling a bottle of water, sample this and sample that. And I think that they was very generous and very friendly to those because they see their mom doing that, you know. And even when I was doing demo, while they were in school, they would come over Christmas break, and we would hit the ferry building because I have Christmas break also, and we wouldn't go on vacation. Both Natasha and I would just stand in the ferry building trying to move the product for the shop. And then after Christmas, we, you know, take vacation together. But ever since I started making the cooking paste and sauce, both of them, every time, they never, we never had to worry that they embarrass or anything. Because it's so easily be embarrassed when you're young, you know. Your parents used to be leading a group of engineers now standing in front of the shop asking for sample, for people to sample, right? So, yeah.
Tell us how the business has changed since those early days, sampling the product at the Ferry Building in San Francisco to where it is today.
Well, it's I think it's it has the different awards that we receive. It gave me confidence that there's other things that we should introduce to the American palates. You know, like some of the Cambodian spices and sausages that we crave for, grow up with, you know. I couldn't wait to try those and introduce that. And also, I was happy that when I started this product, the reason it took me a long time to get it in the jar, not so much about not confident, but I'm very picky about what go in there. So if you look at the ingredient in the paste right now, it's very clean, it's all natural. For example, even like citric acid, I refuse to put citric acid in my food because it's not something that I can see in my kitchen. And we'll go to, you know, spend a lot of time pick and choose the ingredient. I refuse to use the dry ingredients. And I think because of that, when we won the award, we were automatically feasible into the food service arena because it's efficient, it's clean, easy to use. It's efficient because it's very concentrated, so you don't have to pack a whole quantity to marinate something. And part of it is because lemongrass is a kind of spice that it's good, but you don't want to use too much. So I actually control that by adding, you know, the flavor in there that's very concentrated so people won't use too much of it.
Yeah, and it has, I mean, so like the little like the marinated chicken we tried, it's kind of still lingering. It has this nice, like, you know, like lingering flavor that I'm still enjoying like 15 minutes later.
What have been some of the biggest challenges, the biggest obstacles, the hardest things to do in building this business?
I think it's, I guess maybe you could categorize them like growing pains. You know, how do you get from like what Jenny was describing of demoing and moving a very small volume to having partners and supply chain that can actually deliver quality product and shipping and fulfillment, warehouse. All of those things have, I guess they're just natural progressions. But there's been, you know, some of them were hard lessons learned, you know, and you just kind of got to power on, you know, and encourage each other and how do we get through a particular challenge, you know, and then move forward. But I think some of, we've met some terrific people and we've learned some lessons that we would say, oh, we'll never do that step again.
Can you share one of those?
Yeah. What lessons can maybe some other entrepreneurs can learn from?
You know, it's, and it's hard. I can really empathize for everyone that goes through this because you got to have backups. You know, for partners that you think you can count on, right? And things can change in their organization that you don't have access to, right? So it's like you always have to have a backup.
And yeah, Ethan's nodding his head. I bet you've experienced this.
We're going through. I have a spice business. Company. We're going through. Anyway, our glass jar supplier ran out and can't get more, and so for 6 weeks we've been scrambling to find it.
Exactly.
It seems like the simplest part of the supply chain. We're sourcing from, you know, small farms in 11 countries.
Like Zanzibar.
That works fine. But this the stupid jar that we put the spices in, we can't get them. Anyway,
it's exactly the same sort of thing. But you wouldn't really anticipate that. Like glass is glass, and you know, they can crank them out. But that happens. We had last year similarly. Our glass supplier was fine, but the lid supply was out, and we're like, what? How can you make glasses?
So basically, like, have a backup for each thing because you never know. Yeah. That is really, that is very good
in
advice.
In life, too, I think maybe. Have backups, build redundancies in your
That's getting a little deep.
What are some other pieces of advice that you would share with aspiring or early stage food entrepreneurs?
I think the, you know, some, my answer is kind of baked into what Jenny was just saying on being very particular about your process. If you work with some partner, or as you're growing and you're working with some, you know, factory or packer somewhere, and they try to get you to change, that's, you know, warning sign. You know, no matter how much they say they're an expert or something, it's your product, right? So you should listen to them and learn. You might learn something new, but our, you know, usually we know best, I think, right? Because we know what the product needs to taste like when it's done. And when we formulate our recipes that we share with our customers, like how do you use a product, right? Then you're like, well, now you got to redo all those recipes, and maybe it's probably not going to taste like grandma's, you know, when you're done. So.
And I think the other thing for me is it's not that always rosy story, but don't give up. You know, just keep at it. No, don't give up too quickly. Because especially if you're managing the risk, you know, the different steps that you eliminate those risks and have backup and all that, you had already built an infrastructure that, you know, maybe this sauce won't make it, but all the process you've done already, it should be something else. Yeah, and surrounded yourself with people who really believe in you, because family probably not a good one.
No, that's a really great takeaway. Somehow, like, balance, like, being authentic and listening to yourself and believing in yourself and, like, not get... I mean, I'm not, like, in the food manufacturing business, but that is so, like, relevant to what I'm doing right now also. So I think that's kind of, like, universally applicable.
That's so true, especially when it's come to food, you know. My brother was saying, what the heck are you doing? You know, it's like, I almost embarrassed him because I was like leading a group of engineers and he's so proud of him, and all of a sudden I'm becoming a hot sauce lady. But it's like, okay, you just have to stand back, you know? And you have to go with it, go with what you believe.
Yeah. In the last few minutes of the interview, we're going to pivot to our rapid fire, fun, light question segment. So I guess we can ask the question.
Alternate.
Alternate?
Yeah.
Okay. Or, yeah. Valerie, you want to start?
Oh, sure. Okay. I'll start with Chani. What is your favorite American food to eat?
Steak. Oh, prime rib.
That's like such a great Midwest answer. I love that.
How do you like your steak cooked?
Medium rare.
Good. Yeah. Classic. Yeah,
medium rare.
Nebraska raised you well.
No steak sauce. Just medium rare, salt and pepper. And just let me just chew on it.
So Kent, what's your favorite Cambodian food?
You know what? It's probably the kurung, the lemongrass paste. And there's so many recipes that it works well with. I'm going to have to go with the Cambodian curry, which is, it uses the lemongrass paste as a base ingredient. And Cambodian curry powder, the flavor, it smells like a curry, right? But it's not so forward, right? It's not so very strong, and it's just so savory. When Chani makes it with little deep fried potatoes. Oh, that's it.
Oh,
yes, yeah. Please.
Oh, I just I felt that.
So that my mom make curry. She, even before I know what French fry is, she actually do French fry, but in a cube. This is all in Cambodia. She deep fry them. She put it aside. She make the roux with the curry and lemongrass, and then add the California chili powder until it's all, you know, become like aromatic and this and that, and the next thing you know, it's like it's completely different than any curry you try. Yeah.
Wow.
Stop by, cool. I'll make some for you.
Next time we're in San Francisco.
Yeah, that's right. You should.
If you could master any skill overnight, what would that skill be? You could both take this, or one of you.
Tag team. Yeah.
I don't know if this is really a skill. Maybe like a superpower?
Or sure, superpower. That was going to be a different question, but let's go.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's go now.
Definitely anti-gravity. Mm. Yeah, that would be it.
What would you do with your anti-gravity power?
I think, you know, there's... I would just feel liberated. I could. What couldn't I do? Right? I mean, it's like I could... the sky's the limit at that point.
Could go no anywhere. Pun intended?
Yeah.
Literally.
Chani, what about you? What would your superpower be?
I want to make sure that I have food enough for everybody in the world. No children, nobody should go to bed being hungry.
You know, we get we have a lot of entrepreneurs on the podcast, and transportation is often the superpower that people go to. So it's so nice to hear somebody have a truly altruistic superpower.
We're in the food, right?
So yeah, absolutely.
Favorite ice cream flavor?
I don't know if they still have it, but I love
Rocky Road. Yeah. You know, I think...
But Rocky Road and pecan butter.
Oh, yes. Maybe butter...
Old flavor?
Butter pecan.
Butter pecan.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I think that those are like flavors from the 90s, because those are the flavors I remember growing up. And my favorite one is also disappearing, which is chocolate chip cookie dough. You just can't... You can't find these flavors anymore.
I know.
Yeah.
What's the one of the best meals you've ever had for, say, under $5 or $10? It's a tough question.
Yeah, I know, right?
You said they go to a lot of fancy restaurants.
Oh, right. Okay.
I'm thinking...
still love
tech
spam.
Perks.
Spam?
I still love spam.
How do you...
Spam breakfast.
How do you cook spam?
I just slice it about like a centimeter thick and just pan fry until it's brown.
That's good. Haven't had that for so long.
Just spam and orange juice and coffee.
Breakfast of champions. No.
I'd have to say there's a few famous dumpling shops in Shanghai, right? And it's probably the Yang's fried dumpling.
What makes a good dumpling for you?
Well, these particular ones are just large, and they basically have soup inside with the meat filling, and they're pan fried as well. So really crispy on one side, sesame seeds on top. So they're maybe the best dumplings in the world.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
K kitchen. Go ahead.
Okay,
Oh, kitchen utensil you can't live without.
Oh boy, I use a lot of chopstick.
Oh, that's a good one.
Different sizes or shapes. What's your favorite set of chopsticks?
The long one. The one like 2 feet long.
Yeah.
I've never
then
seen
you can those. Steal food from other people's plates.
Yeah, that's right.
I thought for sure she was going to say scale because she weighs everything.
Oh, wow. Oh, is that like the background and like
that's the background
the science
scientist.
And mathematics?
Everything's down to the gram. Where's my scale? Right? I can't make this right.
I have a pop-up. I carry scale with me. Right?
Oh. So,
sharp knife and scale. I'll drop, you know, and I actually buy sets of sharp knife. Cheap, mm-hmm. but they're really easy to work with and sharp. Every time I go to a different part of the country cooking, I take one with me and I don't have to carry it back. But it's really that good.
What's your knife brand? What knife do you recommend?
The one that I had and keep in, you know, with me all the time. I can't even pronounce the name, but it's a Japanese one. What's it called, Ken? Do you remember the name?
Oh, those heavy
Kokis.
Ones. But the ones you're talking about, I think it's a Kiwi brand or something.
The one that I use all the time.
Oh, those little Thai style. Or
Kiwi brand.
Yeah, it's like a little wooden handle, kind of a rectangular shaped blade.
So you don't have to sharpen it, just leave it with the hole.
Yeah, I have one in my knife drawer at home. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. And Jenny runs into chefs all the time and say, oh, you use the same knife as I do in the show. So it's a, you know, it's for all of us.
Yeah.
It's easy to shop. It's, you know,
inexpensive.
Inexpensive. Yeah. You forget it someplace, it's not a big deal.
Yeah. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Where can our listeners find your products and find out more about you and your story? Where can they find the book?
I had the book on my website. Actually, it's combined with oncofood.com. And also in
Amazon.
Yes, on Amazon.
And your website, encorefood, ANGKOR food.com?
Yes.
That's right. That's right. And then in the city, in Manhattan here, it's in Calustians has it, Hudson's and Charles at both of their locations. Online, Amazon, Kroger online, mm-hmm. Our site has it, and so quite a number of shops in the West Coast as well, and so growing.
And do you have a social media presence where people can follow you?
Yeah, we have Uncle Food in Instagram, and I have my
Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. I think they're all Uncle Food, so you can follow us there and.
But if you want to focus on the book part of it, I have my own website, Channy Chilox, on Instagram and Twitter. CHANNYCHHILAUX.
Great. Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
As always, you can reach us via our email, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org, via our social media, YFood Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. We're also wrapping up a Heritage Radio Network fundraising drive. So much fun. So if you like listening to our show, if you like listening to all of the other great shows on Heritage Radio Network, please visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate. It's not a mystery. You know what to do. heritageradio.org/donate. And if you donate $500, I will put together a spice set for you, customized to your cooking style and flavor profile. So $500, you know, no big deal, whatever. Visit the website heritageradionetwork.org/donate. I'm Ethan Frisch. You can reach me via my spice company, ethan@burlapandbarrel.com, Burlap and Barrel on Instagram.
And I'm Valerie Lomas. You can find me at Foodie in New York on all over social, website, all the same.
Thanks to Amanda, our awesome sound engineer for today's episode, and to the Red Crickets for our theme song, which is called Blind. See you next week.
Thank you. We were face to face and back to my back. Went to a place that only I can know.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the food world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.